This call is being recorded.
There you go, John. You're back. You get it. Perfect. We can see it.
That's a cool slide.
Yeah, I bet you've given this a few times by now, John.
Industries, airlines, autos, circuit, what would you call it? Like micro trips, just all sectors of the economy kind of highlighting how they've been impacted by the coronavirus. I thought it was pretty interesting. The folks from General Motors, they had no automobile manufacturing in the month of April. I mean, we know that because they shuttered plants, but just to see it on a chart was interesting.
Yeah.
So many of those charts are just amazing. Just the way things that have turned so quickly off.
Yeah, it's hard to imagine that, you know, where we find ourselves and where we were, you know, 3 months ago.
I'm going to hit mute so everyone gets muted as they come on. So John, when after you get muted, don't forget to unmute yourself.
Okay. You can still see my slides, correct?
We can see you. Yeah, we can see your slides.
Okay.
Well, welcome, folks. I see a few people are starting to join. We've got a dozen or so. We'll give a minute or two for folks to join in. We appreciate everyone being flexible. Appreciate Dr. John Newton from the Chief Economist with American Farm Bureau being on the call with us today to share some economic updates and insights that he has amidst COVID. Want to note a couple things, and I'll probably circle back around to these again. The first quarter fundraising results are out for our battle against introduction of the gray wolf into Colorado. And I am very proud to report that a good deal due to Farm Bureau's participation, that we on the no side of the campaign outraised the pro wolf proponents by $20,000 this quarter. So good job to everyone within Farm Bureau. We appreciate all those counties chipping in, digging into their pockets and supporting. From Farm Bureau's contribution standpoint, we have contributed more than $150,000, the largest being the fundraiser that Rio Blanco County put on. But several counties, I don't have a number in front of me, but many, many counties have chipped in. So we do appreciate that. We still have money left that we can match if counties want to give a little bit more. So you might talk about that on your next county board meeting. Other thing I want to mention is for the third year in a row, Farm Bureau was recognized as one of the best places to work in Denver. And those announcements will be coming out soon. We just got the notification the other day, something that we're very, very extremely proud of. For a nonprofit organization our size, I think there was more than 300 companies in the Denver and Colorado areas that were nominated. Only 65 get chosen, and we were amongst those. And this is the third year in a row that we've been recognized as one of the best places to work. So really a tip of the hat to the board for setting a great strategic plan for us and for our staff, getting all on board and implementing that strategic plan. I see that we've got about 30 folks or so joined us today. Appreciate everyone being here. We have with us Dr. John Newton, who's the chief economist for American Farm Bureau, going to give us some economic insights on what we can expect in agriculture. So, Dr. John, I will turn it over to you.
Thank you so much. And everyone can hear me okay?
We can hear you great.
All right. Well, fantastic. I appreciate the opportunity to join you all. I wish we had better information to share, but I think, you know, we had our March board meeting at AFBS Washington, D.C. office March 11th, 12th. And on March 13th, the coronavirus, the World Health Organization declared it a pandemic, and the Farm Bureau office has been closed ever since in Washington, D.C., and we've been on stay-at-home orders since that point in time. The impact of the coronavirus on food and agriculture continues to develop. Challenges we had at the very beginning continue to be there, but as folks are very well aware, new challenges are beginning to emerge the longer that this virus persists. What we did at American Farm Bureau is immediately we began to convene calls throughout the week with the State Farm Bureau presidents, as well as the State Farm Bureau National Affairs coordinators. We are on the phone at least twice a week to gather information on the challenges that farmers and ranchers are facing out there. We've been in close contact with the administration, close contact with other ag trade organizations here in Washington, D.C. We've had a number of calls. We had a call. Our first call with the administration official was with Deputy Secretary Sinski. We've also had a call with Undersecretary Ibaugh, Undersecretary Northey. We've had calls with the Farm Credit Institution. And then today we had Chairman Peterson from the House Ag Committee join us to talk about his efforts, especially around keeping livestock facilities open, his concerns with Smithfield Foods being a Chinese-owned company, and then also on what to expect with the upcoming coronavirus food assistance package, which we hope to see the details very soon. When we think about where we were in terms of where the farm economy was before this started, USDA had projected farm-related net cash income was going to fall in 2020, down about 2%. We are expected record production of livestock products, beef, poultry, dairy, and hogs. Strong production in corn, wheat, soybeans. Strong demand in those products, but overall weaker prices. Net cash income was projected to be lower than last year, in large part due to the decline in trade assistance dollars that were paid out in 2018 and 2019. And we've been in a down farm economy for some time now, really going back to 2014. I think through 2012, 13, 14, we saw commodity prices hit record highs. And I think, you know, one of the things we all know is when prices are high, output is likely to expand. They always say the cure for high prices is high prices, and production expanded pretty significantly after the high price years of 2011 through 14. At the same time, exports slowed, the Chinese economy slowed, and production increased around the world. And as a result, we've seen weaker commodity prices really for 8 years now. It rivals the downturns we've experienced during other farm financial crises in terms of comparing our net cash income. And over an eight-year period in the 80s, cash income fell by 45%, and today it's fallen by nearly 30%. And this is all before the coronavirus. And what we've seen in the last 7 to 8 weeks as a result of the coronavirus has caused significant disruptions in the farm economy. So where are we on the coronavirus curve? As you know, it was declared a pandemic in mid-March. And by the end of March, confirmed cases in the U.S. began to expand pretty rapidly. We hit our first peak in early April at about 33,000 cases. New cases, these are day changes per day. And then since that point in time, we've had peaks and valleys and new cases. And it really, I think, highlights, you know, after we got under control in New York, you started to see other parts of the country expand in their number of cases. And I think over the last 2 weeks, most of the new coronavirus cases are in areas with, you know, meatpacking facilities, the workers working in close proximity there. And I think that's justification. That's why we're seeing these peaks and valleys, you know, over the last 7 to 8 weeks. We are starting to slow down. You know, we added only 22,000 new confirmed cases yesterday, but we're not out of the woods yet. I think so as economies around the country start to reopen, I think we're going to see consumers continue to practice social distancing. I think people will continue to use personal protective equipment. So I don't think they're going to reopen the economy and we're just going to get back to business as usual. Restaurants will still probably limit the number of patrons, and as will bars. Airline travel may be slow to recover. I was on a call this morning with the chief economist from Boeing, indicating that they don't think airline traffic will recover for 3 to 4 years. When we look across the country on kind of where we're seeing coronavirus cases growing, it's in you know, some of these rural areas. Now it's important to note that you know, these are, in some cases you have 10 cases that go to 20, and that's 100% increase. So this isn't indicative of how widespread the virus is. It's more about where are the number of cases growing and where are they contracting. So it's still growing across many portions of rural America. And so I think that's why it's important for people to continue to social distance and practice CDC guidelines so that we can limit the spread of the coronavirus. The first, I think, shoe to drop in terms of food and agriculture that we noticed right away was the closure of restaurants and bars across the country. And in 2018, Americans spent $1.7 trillion on food. More than half of that was in restaurants and other food away from home. So what we needed to do, and what agribusinesses and food companies quickly found out, it's very difficult to refabricate production facilities from servicing the restaurant business and moving that product through the retail channels. The cuts of beef, for example, are different. The demand for beef is different at restaurants than it is at the grocery store. The size, the packaging is different in the restaurants versus the grocery store. And many plants, quite frankly, weren't fabricated to just move their production lines to service only one of the channels. And so as restaurants were closing or significantly seeing their business decline, you started to have some backups in the supply chain. One of the first things we saw were you know, milk processors around the country were requesting that farmers dump their milk. We still had plenty of product moving through the grocery chain in terms of beef and poultry. As a matter of fact, you know, the cutout values in mid-March accelerated for beef and poultry as retailers were scrambling that first wave of people going to the grocery store during stay-at-home orders pushed grocery store sales up. In March, grocery store sales were $73 billion. Whereas food service and drinking establishments saw their sales decline to $50 billion, down 25%, the largest year-over-year decline that we've ever seen in terms of restaurant sales. One would expect that we will continue to see a lot of the food purchases moving through the grocery store chain. as opposed to the food service and drinking establishment. So that was the first impact we started to see, was those supply chain challenges with respect to grocery stores and food service and drinking establishments. I think as we, you know, the last few weeks, the challenge has been with the coronavirus expanding into many of these meat processing facilities. You first saw workers didn't want to go to these packing plants out of fear of getting the disease. And then once you started to see these plants shut down, so you had processing capacity either shut down or idled or limited due to fewer workers in the plant. We've had conversations with many of the packers who said that they did put in place personal protective equipment in the meat processing facilities to limit or try to prohibit the spread of the coronavirus. But ultimately what we've seen is cattle slaughter last week was down 30% year over year. I believe at this point in time, it's down closer to 45 to 50% year over year. Hog slaughter was down 15% year over year and down considerably from the highs we saw in March. And I think in March, early March, and towards mid to late March, you saw a lot of livestock move to slaughter facilities to try to get ahead of any potential disruptions in the supply chain. Farmers, I think, you know, the Holcomb fire in Kansas was top of their mind when this outbreak began. So you've seen slaughter capacity fall dramatically, not only in the cattle and hog sector, but also in poultry. And that's led to, on the poultry side, the depopulation of flocks or integrators spacing out the delivery of birds. It's happening in the broiler space. Egg layers are having some challenges, as are turkey producers. On the hog side, it's estimated that potentially 7 million hogs will be euthanized as a result of the coronavirus. They just don't have the processing capacity there. And on the cattle side, you know, there's been efforts to try to slow down the growth. And I think recent proposals, I don't know where the cattlemen are on a particular idea, but yesterday an idea surfaced, a cattle set-aside program. I don't know where the money would come from that, but it would be a program to pay producers to slow down the growth of their animals. I believe it's estimated to pay about $2.90 a head for up to 75 days. Again, I don't know where that's going to land. There was an effort to do a similar supply management style program from the dairy industry. And my understanding was Secretary Perdue didn't want to have a supply management program, thought it would be too cumbersome to try to administer. So I'm not sure where the cattle set-aside program will ultimately go. But there was a similar effort by the dairy farmers to do a supply management program tied to the coronavirus relief package. What we've seen across all the commodities and ethanol as well is very, very significant volatility in the futures markets, in the cash markets, and we've seen significant price declines. Hog prices at one point in time were down more than 50%. Milk prices are down 30 to 40%. Ethanol declined by 30% or more, in large part due to the decline in gasoline demand. And so ethanol production fell, ethanol prices fell. Ethanol processors were buying less corn. So corn prices have fallen about 20%. Cotton prices at one point in time were down more than 30%. But as kind of some of the economies in Southeast Asia have begun to reopen manufacturing plants, you're seeing cotton prices improve. Soybean prices have fallen about 13%. Wheat, depending on what type of wheat, you know, down about 8 to 10%. And rice prices for new crop, relatively unchanged, pretty stable there. But a lot of producers have been negatively impacted, seen prices fall sharply. There are other producers that we don't have good price information on. So if you're specialty livestock, raising, you know, lamb or maybe wool for fur producers, they've seen their business disrupted considerably. And I think we're going to get some assistance for them, but it just may take some time until we learn the details of what exactly it'll look like. The CARES Act that the president signed probably close to a month ago now at this point included $50 billion in agriculture and food assistance. 18% of it, or nearly $9 billion, was in child nutrition programs, nearly $16 billion for SNAP. But for farmers, I think all eyes were on the $9.5 billion given to the Office of the Secretary. That was money that he could begin to design safety net programs for farmers and ranchers right away. He had about $6 billion left in his Commodity Credit Corporation, so he was able to craft a $16 billion package for producers in terms of direct payments. And then Congress also is going to replenish the Commodity Credit Corporation by $14 billion in July. So the secretary had about $23 billion in new money to provide some support packages to farmers. And then there's an effort underway now to get even more assistance in this fourth relief package for farmers and ranchers to the tune of $50 to $60 billion. But we don't have the details yet of that just now. What we do know is the secretary announced about 2 weeks ago a coronavirus food assistance package that included $5 billion in direct payments for cattle producers, $4 billion for row crops, dairy, $3 billion, specialty crops, $2.1 billion, hogs, $1.6 billion, and other products, about $500 million. The rules on this CFAP program are with the Office of Management and Budget. Once they approve the rules, the secretary is going to open sign up for these programs with the expectation to start delivering money to producers by the end of this month or in early June. One of the things that we surface right away with this is that the direct payments to producers, we need to address payment limitations. Payment limitations will leave some farmers out in the cold with respect to the assistance that they really need to recover from the coronavirus. We don't know yet what payment limitations are going to be. Earlier, we thought it would be $125,000 or $250,000 per operation, so $125,000 per commodity and $250,000. There was a 60 Minutes documentary. I'm going to call it a hit piece this weekend that went after direct payments from the Trade Assistance Program and might be one of the most significant and damaging pieces at a time when we're trying to get payment limits raised. They came out with quite the hit piece on agriculture. So we'll see what happens on this in the coming days as we get the details on the CFAP package. But I would anticipate those monies going out pretty quick, and then the secretary starting to think about what the second $14 billion in July is going to look like. This comes at a time when farm debt across the country is record high. Real estate debt is a record $265 billion. And when you talk to the farm credit folks, and I spent some time with them earlier this year, one of the things that they're concerned about or were concerned about was the impact of high levels of unemployment on off-farm income and what that does to the capacity of farmers and ranchers to service their debt. And we're going to get unemployment numbers tomorrow. And I would imagine the estimates from the finance folks is unemployment's going to be around 16 to 20%. As a result of the economic slowdown related to the coronavirus. So to the extent that impacts off-farm income, it could impact the ability of farmers to service their debt. Now, we've asked the department to provide some guaranteed loans through the farm credit system to producers so that they can get an injection of working capital to help folks bridge the gap until we get to the other side of the coronavirus. That's one of the most important things, is making sure folks have the working capital they need so that we do not lose farms during this critical point in time. think the other major challenge that we're facing is on trade. And I think at the beginning of this year, many folks were optimistic that we were finally going to turn the corner on trade, that the phase one agreement with China, USMCA, and the US-Japan trade agreement would help to increase demand and potentially lift farm commodity prices. And China was supposed to buy about $40 billion worth of product in 2020. And I can tell you now that they're on pace to buy about $11 billion this fiscal year and maybe only $11 billion in 2020. They've only bought $3 billion in agricultural products through the first quarter. So they're more than $30 billion behind on what they need to reach their phase one commitments. And so I think that the lack of purchases by the Chinese will become a bigger and bigger issue as we get closer to the election and whether or not the administration chooses to fold up the phase one agreement with China. And if that's the case, that'll be another demand shock to farmers and ranchers. So, you know, we're going to continue to monitor that. That's why it's important for the secretary to have all the resources he needs to support farm prices and farm income through right now the coronavirus and what may ultimately end up being a shortfall in Chinese phase one purchases. So with that concludes my remarks, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Dr. John. I wish you had better news. Sobering slides and sobering information. If anyone does have a question, just remember to hit ** to unmute your phone or unmute on your computer.
Chad, can you hear me? This is Don.
We can hear you, Don.
Yes, John, regarding this potential set-aside proposal, I guess you might call it or whatever. Granted, it's just an idea right now, but how much thought have they put into that? You know, who's going to be eligible for it? You know, the idea of ownership and the complication of packer owners. And the bottom line question I have is, if somehow they can find the money to pay for this, what impact do you see economically, realistically? Is it going to do nothing other than just push the supply farther down the road and therefore may cause the depressed price for live cattle to remain longer?
So that's an excellent question, President Shawcroft. And you know, I've seen the proposal. We've yet to do you know, a deep analysis of it. And I think, you know, depending on what kind of feedback we get from folks on the Hill on whether or not this thing is a reality, I have yet to have any state farm bureaus reach out asking about it, but I can check with our livestock economist or Scott Bennett, our lobbyist on livestock issues, to see if other folks have reached out. But you're right. I don't know where they would get the money for it. At this point, potentially in this next CARES package, but Congress, you know, they did allocate money for livestock programs in the previous package, but they stopped short of telling the department how to craft the assistance packages. And I know the secretary's not a huge fan of these type of set aside programs, the challenge to administer it, the implications on that these animals would have to stay in the set-aside program for, I believe, 75 days, what that could do to the market prices. So I think a thorough analysis would need to be done before, you know, weighing in on it. I don't think American Farm Bureau has any policy on this particular issue, so we'll have to look at that as well. But again, the idea came from the Beef Alliance, which is a group of Packers. I think not Packers, are they, President Shawcroft? But
yeah,
are they Packers? Alliance area.
Go ahead, I'm sorry.
Are they the Beef Alliance? They run in Kansas, Colorado, and a few other states. Is where this proposal came from, and we I've reached out to the people that drafted it to get more information on this particular issue.
Yeah. All right. Well, definitely a concerning issue, and you know I'm sure you heard Chairman Pearson mention today he didn't think there was enough money in the whole world to solve this problem in the United States, much less solve the problem globally. And that part, you know, definitely is of a concern too. And his comments that he mentioned, I'm sure you can probably restate them much better than I could, regarding the impact currently for, I believe it was ethanol, I believe he was referring to ethanol plants who are trying to live up to their agreements, but that he couldn't buy corn at certainly the current market price in order to process it and use it to produce the ethanol that they had committed to deliver. I think that's what he said. I wonder if you had some comments about that and how that might relate to what might happen in the other parts of agriculture if all of these programs, even that are now, the final details are not yet released, but if they are implemented and you have those billions and billions of dollars that satisfy, at least, quote, satisfy those people that allow them to wait to market product that can be held. What's the real economic impact of that? Does that make sense to you?
It certainly does. So what Chairman Pearson was alluding to is that because people got so much money in trade assistance last year and the year before, that they could sit on their grain in storage or oilseed and wait for a better price down the line. And there's likely some truth to that. But there's also the capacity and ability for these ethanol plants or any of these other processors to bid up the basis. And the basis is very, very wide right now. So if ethanol plants want to, you know, free up some of this corn that folks are sitting on, they've got to pay for it. And the ethanol plants, you know, can't necessarily pay what they need to pay to get the corn because the ethanol price per gallon is so low. And so what they've asked for is USDA to provide money so that they could purchase the feedstock. So give the ethanol plants 50 cents a bushel or some number along those lines that they can then use to help bid up the price of corn and get it moving. So I think that's what Chairman Pearson was referencing.
All right, thank you. Any other questions, Chad?
Yeah, I believe Mark Arnish has a question. Mark's a board member from Eastern Colorado.
Well, thank you for your time this afternoon, Dr. Newton. Can you hear me okay?
I certainly can.
I think Don kind of stole much of my thunder when he was talking about supply controls and livestock. And from my own personal perspective, it's very dangerous when we start talking about supply controls, especially in commodity grains such as corn, wheat, and soybeans. But are there any other kinds of conversations out there to help alleviate this overburdening amount of supply that we're running into, not only in the 2020 corn crop, wheat crop, soybean crop, but potentially into the 2021 crop year? We heard last week from Undersecretary Ibaugh that he said, well, he has confidence in the American farmer that they will respond to signals from the marketplace. But when just about every major commodity market is signaling us not to produce the crop, we don't really have a lot of other choices. Beyond supply control, which I still believe is a very dangerous conversation, are there any other avenues or conversations happening right now to help alleviate some of our concerns?
You know, and I didn't put this in the slides to you all, but I believe President Shawcroft, they were distributed following the board meeting, the slides I presented at that meeting on one of the challenges that we have is while the economic incentive here says plant fewer acres of corn, for example, if we plant 95 million acres of corn this year, 96 million acres of corn, we're going to have a carryout of over 3 billion bushels. And as Chairman Peterson said on the call earlier, that's a corn price that starts with a 2, a Chicago corn price, not a Western Corn Belt corn price. And so the challenge is, while we've got depressed prices here at home, when you convert our commodity values to the local currency value in our competing markets, they've got record prices. So for example, the US dollar to the Brazilian real tells the Brazilian farmer to expand acres, to grow that second crop corn, and they've got short season varieties to do that. The economic signal to them is to continue to expand as quick as possible. Same thing in the Black Sea region in Russia. Same thing for our competitors in the dairy space. So a strong dollar creates different economic incentives. And even if we had a set-aside program or an expansion of the conservation reserve program, the price signal of us taking acres offline and moving our prices higher is only going to be a stronger signal to add those acres elsewhere around the world. So, and I don't think it's a strong dollar necessarily, but a weak Brazilian real and other weak currencies around the world. And the economic uncertainty in Brazil is very real. Brazil's dealing with the coronavirus in a much different way than we are. I think their president's laughing at it, and it's expected that they actually have more confirmed cases than the United States, but they're not taking it very seriously. But to back up, I think it's the currency situation that creates a challenging environment for us. And on the call with Chairman Peterson today, as President Shawcross mentioned, there's not enough money to help the farmers that need it. And the farm bill wasn't designed for this type of situation as well. I hope that provides some context to the question.
Well, it's certainly a very challenging and difficult environment we find ourselves in. And I think Colin Peterson's point about there isn't enough money in the world to solve this is right on the money. Basically, in the United States, in my view, we really need to stand up our livestock industry, because so much of what we produce here in the Midwest, or you could say, or the High Plains, is funneled into the livestock industry. And their successes and failures become commodity grains' successes and failures. So I really believe it starts with having a vibrant livestock industry here in the High Plains, of kind of the heartland of the United States. But I think your point is very spot on. Brazil in particular can really dictate a lot to us in terms of what we do with our soybeans and corn in particular, to a lesser extent wheat. But it looks like we're going to probably take some lumps here for the next 3 to 5 years in commodity agriculture.
Thanks, Mark. Any other questions for Dr. Newton? If you do have a question, just a reminder, press ** to unmute or unmute if you're joining us through your computer. Wanted to remind everybody that we've been recording this, and we'll follow up with a webinar, so folks who are listening on their phones can go back and view the slides and see what Dr. Newton was presenting. Were there any other questions out there?
May I make one more comment?
Please.
One other thing I forgot to mention on this that we've been actively involved with is this very, very wide difference between the cutout values that retailers are paying for beef and pork and the farm gate prices. We've had a number of calls with the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. Chairman Tarbert, President Duvall sent him a letter, and I believe, assuming the Farm Bureau Executive Committee approves this, President Duvall wants to form a working group with cattle, hog, and lamb producers to evaluate spot market activity that we've seen and futures market activity that we've seen and potentially make some recommendations on how we think things can be improved. So that's probably another really big issue that I did not touch on in my earlier remarks, but we are very much engaged in it.
Good point.
Dad, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, just one more question or at least comment, see if you had any follow-up to it. Another thing that was, I mean, I just keep throwing bad news to everybody, but perhaps a realistic challenge without a doubt for any further financial assistance like this for agriculture was really typified by what Chairman Peterson said regarding his colleagues and how he perceives that they believe that agriculture has already gotten what it needs. Any follow-up to that, Huckerman?
I think that when the narrative that, you know, the MFP money made people more than whole, the CNN hit piece certainly didn't help folks, but you know, people are fairly disconnected from the farm, and we tried to communicate, you know, the challenges of agriculture. The Ag Committee folks certainly understand that, but I think that there was some resistance from some folks, even on the Ag Committee, into expanding the Commodity Credit Corporation's borrowing authority up to $50 billion last time. Some of Chairman Peterson's colleagues think that the MFP money was not fairly distributed and left some commodities out in the cold, and I would agree that several commodities probably didn't get the assistance that they needed under the trade assistance. And so, you know, you have camps that think that farmers have gotten enough already. And then you have camps that think that USDA shouldn't just have a blank check. And then you have camps that say, and as Chairman Peterson pointed out, Congress needs to have more say on how these monies are allocated and spent. And I think, you know, I'm talking with our farm policy lobbyist Andrew Walmsley about this. If they want to provide more assistance to agriculture but do it through the Ag Committees, I think we're perfectly comfortable doing that, because that's how we've done, you know, farm bill after farm bill for decades, is through the Ag Committee. So we'd be comfortable there, but it is important to highlight, you know, the needs of agriculture, and I think, you know, we're working to do that. But you know, the other thing that we pointed out is the CARES Act was $2 trillion, and the agricultural portion of that was about slightly more than 1.4%. So we didn't get a lot of the massive assistance. And then the Paycheck Protection Program didn't work for agriculture, quite frankly, at all. And so we've been working to point that out as well. But there is bill text in the House to raise the CCC up to $68 billion. I believe it's coming out of Georgia. So hopefully we get that.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I believe Gary Melcher has a question. Gary, go ahead.
Thank you again for your time. It's definitely the more we get into it, the more complex it gets. But if I guess my question would be, I see the need to potentially raise the limits and everything, but if there's not enough money into the program, and kind of like the first bailout of just the small business stuff, a lot of small businesses got left out because the larger businesses went in and applied for all the money first. Is there a potential of that problem happening with this in ag as well? If we raise the limits, is the small farmer going to get left out?
Once we see the payment rules, I think we'll be able to identify to what extent the payment limits will cover certain sectors of agriculture. I don't think that we're going to run out of money, but if we do, that only emphasizes why we need more assistance. And you know, I think what I would urge folks to do is, as soon as this information is released, and we'll send out a bulletin to all the state and national affairs coordinators, is to work with your FSA office to get in there and get your paperwork done. That can ensure you'll get your assistance as quick as possible. But we did have Undersecretary Northey with us a couple weeks ago, and he indicated that they think that there'll be enough money for the payment rates that they're going to do this go round. But the secretary will get another $14 billion in July in CCC replenishment to potentially craft additional relief programs if they're needed.
There any other questions? If there are, hit ** on your phone or unmute if you're joining us with your computer. Well, hearing none, thank you, Dr. Newton. We do appreciate your time. We'll follow up with a recording of a webinar so folks that were listening on your phones can view the slides at a later time. Thank you again, Dr. Newton, Chief Economist for American Farm Bureau. We do appreciate everything that you do and your time joining us today.
Thank you so much, and thanks for the invite to come to your convention this year. Hopefully we're back to normal and I can get out there to Denver and join you all.
We hope you can join us as well. Just a reminder for folks, next week we're going to continue this series of member update calls. We'll have Zach Riley, our National Affairs staff, talk about direct payments for livestock producers and other relief programs to help those that have been hit hardest by the effects of COVID. And then in 2 weeks, we'll resume our policy advisory committee call as the legislature will be back in session starting May 18th. Both of those calls will be back at 7:30 a.m. So we appreciate the flexibility that you all have had the last couple of weeks, but we'll move back to that early morning time. Wanted to wrap up with a couple of high notes, I think. In the battle against wolf introduction, the wolf campaign, if you didn't hear at the beginning of the call, our No Cat campaign outraised the proponents of the wolf initiative by 20,000 in this first quarter. So hats off to all those individuals as well as county farm bureaus that have contributed. Farm Bureau in total has donated more than $150,000 to fight this really awful initiative. And the state still has more money to match if counties are thinking about contributing or have more to contribute. So we do have more to do there, and the campaign moves forward. That initiative hasn't changed anything as far as the ballot goes, and so we're looking at fighting it. Other announcement that I want to make is congratulations to everyone involved in Farm Bureau. Once again, for the third year in a row, we were recognized as one of the best places to work in Denver by the Denver Business Journal. So hats off to our board for our strategic direction and to our staff for implementing that. With that, I don't have any other announcements other than you'll be able to view the webinar later this week and see the slides if you only joined us by phone today. So thank you all. Appreciate your time as well. Stay safe, and we'll talk to you next week.